bright with fountains and banners by day, with tree lamps and fireworks by night, past Whitehall Palace, where the King holds his weekly council of state, past the Shot Tower, dropping its endless drizzle of molten lead into vats of murky water, further down still to where the river, wide and filthy now, swings in a great curve to the south. This is Limehouse, and here is the child who is going to disappear. He is called Tony Makarios. His mother thinks he's 9 years old, but she has a poor memory that the drink has rotted. He might be 8 or 10. His surname is Greek, but like his age, that is a guess on his mother's part because he looks more Chinese than Greek, and there's Irish and Skraeling and Lascar in him from his mother's side too. Tony's not very bright, but he has a sort of clumsy tenderness that sometimes prompts him to give his mother a rough hug and plant a sticky kiss on her cheeks. The poor woman is usually too fuddled to start such a procedure herself, but she responds warmly enough once she realizes what's happening. At the moment, Tony is hanging about the market in Pye Street. He's hungry. It's early evening and he won't get fed at home. He's got a shilling in his pocket that a soldier gave him for taking a message to his best girl, but Tony's not going to waste that on food when you can pick up so much for nothing. So he wanders through the market, between the old clothes stalls and the fortune paper stalls, the fruitmongers and the fried fish seller, with his little demon on his shoulder, a sparrow, watching this way and that. And when a stallholder and her demon are both looking elsewhere, a brisk chirp sounds, and Tony's hand shoots out and returns to his loose shirt with an apple or a couple of nuts, and finally with a hot pie. The stallholder sees that and shouts, and her cat demon leaps, but Tony's sparrow is aloft and Tony himself halfway down the street already. Curses and abuse go with him, but not far. He stops running at the steps of St. Catherine's Oratory, where he sits down and takes out his steaming battered prize, leaving a trail of gravy on his shirt. And he's being watched. A lady in a long yellow-red fox fur coat, a beautiful young lady whose dark hair falls shining delicately under the shadow of her fur-lined hood, is standing in the doorway of the oratory, half a dozen steps above him. It might be that a service is finishing, for light comes from the doorway behind her, an organ is playing inside, and the lady is holding a jewelled breviary. Tony knows nothing of this. His face contentedly deep in the pie, his toes curled inward and his bare soles together, he sits and chews and swallows while his demon becomes a mouse and grooms her whiskers. The young lady's demon is moving out from beside the fox fur coat. He is in the form of a monkey, but no ordinary monkey. His fur is long and silky and of the most deep and lustrous gold. With sinuous movements he inches down the steps toward the boy and sits a step above him. Then the mouse senses something and becomes a sparrow again, cocking her head a fraction sideways and hops along the stone a step or two. The monkey watches the sparrow. The sparrow watches the monkey. The monkey reaches out slowly. His little hand is black, his nails perfect horny claws, his movements gentle and inviting. The sparrow can't resist. She hops further and further, and then, with a little flutter, up onto the monkey's hand. The monkey lifts her up and gazes closely at her before standing and swinging back to his human, taking the sparrow demon with him. The lady bends her scented head to whisper. And then Tony turns. He can't help it.
"Ratter!"
he says, half in alarm, his mouth full. The sparrow chirps. It must be safe. Tony swallows his mouthful and stares.
"Hello,"
says the beautiful lady.
"What's your name?"
"Tony."
"Where do you live, Tony?"
"Clarice Walk."
"What's in that pie?"
"Beef steak."
"Do you like chocolatle?"
"Yeah."
"As it happens, I've got more chocolatle than I can drink myself. Will you come and help me drink it?"
He's lost already. He was lost the moment his slow-witted demon hopped onto the monkey's hand. He follows the beautiful young lady and the golden monkey down Denmark Street and along to Hangman's Wharf and down King George's steps to a little green door in the side of a tall warehouse. She knocks. The door is opened. They go in. The door is closed. Tony will never come out, at least by that entrance, and he'll never see his mother again. She, poor drunken thing, will think he's run away, and when she remembers him, she'll think it was her fault and sob her sorry heart out. Little Tony Macarias wasn't the only child to be caught by the lady with the golden monkey. He found a dozen others in the cellar of the warehouse, boys and girls, none older than 12 or so. Though since all of them had histories like his, none could be sure of their age. What Tony didn't notice, of course, was the fact that they all had in common. None of the children in that warm and steamy cellar had reached the age of puberty. The kind lady saw him settled on a bench against the wall, and provided by a silent serving woman with a mug of chocolatl from the saucepan on the iron stove. Tony ate the rest of his pie and drank the sweet hot liquor without taking much notice of his surroundings, and the surroundings took little notice of him. He was too small to be a threat, and too stolid to promise much satisfaction as a victim. It was another boy who asked the obvious question.
"Hey, lady, what you got us all here for?"
He was a tough-looking wretch with dark chocolatl on his top lip and a gaunt black rat for a demon. The lady was standing near the door, talking to a stout man with the air of a sea captain, and as she turned to answer she looked so angelic in the hissing naphtha light that all the children fell silent.
"We want your help. You don't mind helping us, do you?"
No one could say a word. They all gazed, suddenly shy. They had never seen a lady like this. She was so gracious and sweet and kind that they felt they hardly deserved their good luck, and whatever she asked, they'd give it gladly so as to stay in her presence a little longer. She told them that they were going on a voyage. They would be well fed and warmly clothed, and those who wanted to could send messages back to their families to let them know they were safe. Captain Magnusson would take them on board his ship very soon, and then when the tide was right, they'd sail out to sea and set a course for the north. Soon those few who did want to send a message to whatever home they had were sitting around the beautiful lady as she wrote a few lines at their dictation, and having let them scratch a clumsy X at the foot of the page, folded it into a scented envelope and wrote the address they told her. Tony would have liked to send something to his mother, but he had a realistic idea of her ability to read it. He plucked at the lady's fox fur sleeve and whispered that he'd like her to tell his mum where he was going and all, and she bent her gracious head close enough to his malodorous little body to hear, and stroked his head and promised to pass the message on. Then the children clustered around to say goodbye. The golden monkey stroked all their demons, and they all touched the fox fur for luck, or as if they were drawing some strength or hope or goodness out of the lady, and she bade them all farewell and saw them in the care of the bold captain on board a steam launch at the jetty. The sky was dark now, the river a mass of bobbing lights. The lady stood on the jetty and waved till she could see their faces no more. Then she turned back inside, with the golden monkey nestled in her breast, and threw the little bundle of letters into the furnace before leaving the way she had come. Children from the slums were easy enough to entice away, but eventually people noticed, and the police were stirred into reluctant action. For a while there were no more bewitchings, but a rumour had been born, and little by little it changed and grew and spread. And when after a while a few children disappeared in Norwich, and then Sheffield, and then Manchester, the people in those places who'd heard of the disappearances elsewhere added the new vanishings to the story, and gave it new strength. And so the legend grew of a mysterious group of enchanters who spirited children away. Some said their leader was a beautiful lady, others said a tall man with red eyes, while a third story told of a youth who laughed and sang to his victims so that they followed him like sheep. As for where they took these lost children, no two stories agreed. Some said it was to hell, under the ground, to fairyland. Others said to a farm where the children were kept and fattened for the table. Others said that the children were kept and sold as slaves to rich Tartars, and so on. But one thing on which everyone agreed was the name of these invisible kidnappers. They had to have a name or not be referred to at all, and talking about them, especially if you were safe and snug at home, or in Jordan College, was delicious. And the name that seemed to settle on them, without anyone's knowing why, was the Gobblers.
"Don't shout late, or the Gobblers will get you.
My cousin in Northampton, she knows a woman whose little boy was took by the Gobblers.
The Gobblers have been in Stratford. They say they're coming south."
And, inevitably,
"Let's play kids and Gobblers."
So said Lyra to Roger, the kitchen boy from Jordan College, one rainy afternoon when they were alone in the dusty attics. He was her devoted slave by this time. He would have followed her to the ends of the earth.
"How'd you play that?"
"You hide and I find you and slice you open, right, like the Gobblers do."
"You don't know what they do. They may not do that at all."
"You're afraid of them, I can tell."
"I ain't. I don't believe in them anyway."
"I do. but I ain't afraid either. I just do what my uncle done last time he came to Jordan. I seen him. He was in the retiring room, and there was this guest who weren't polite, and my uncle just gave him a hard look, and the man fell dead on the spot, with all foam and froth round his mouth.
They never said anything about that in the kitchen. Anyway, you ain't allowed in the retiring room.
Of course not. They wouldn't tell servants about a thing like that. And I have been in the retiring room, so there. Anyway, my uncle's always doing that. He done it to some Tartars when they caught him once. They tied him up, and they was going to cut his guts out. But when the first man come up with the knife, my uncle just looked at him, and he fell dead. So another one come up, and he done the same to him. And finally, there was only one left. My uncle said he'd leave him alive if he untied him, so he did. And then my uncle killed him anyway, just to teach him a lesson.
Roger was less sure about that than about gobblers, but the story was too good to waste. So they took it in turns to be Lord Asriel and the expiring Tartars, using sherbet dip for the foam. However, that was a distraction. Lyra was still intent on playing gobblers, and she inveigled Roger down into the wine cellars, which they entered by means of the butler's spare set of keys. Together they crept through the great vaults, where the college's Tokay and Canary, its Burgundy, its Brantwine, were lying under the cobwebs of ages. Ancient stone arches rose above them, supported by pillars as thick as 10 trees. Irregular flagstones lay underfoot, and on all sides were ranged rack upon rack, tier upon tier of bottles and barrels. It was fascinating. With gobblers forgotten again, the two children tiptoed from end to end, holding a candle in trembling fingers, peering into every dark corner, with a single question growing more urgent in Lyra's mind every moment. What did the wine taste like? There was an easy way of answering that. Lyra, over Roger's fervent protests, picked out the oldest, twistiest, greenest bottle she could find, and, not having anything to extract the cork with, broke it off at the neck. Huddled in the furthest corner, they sipped at the heady crimson liquor, wondering when they'd become drunk, and how they'd tell when they were. Lyra didn't like the taste much, but she had to admit how grand and complicated it was. The funniest thing was watching their two demons, who seemed to be getting more and more muddled, falling over, giggling senselessly, and changing shape to look like gargoyles, each trying to be uglier than the other. Finally, and almost simultaneously, the children discovered what it was like to be drunk.
"Do they like doing this?"
gasped Roger, after vomiting copiously.
"Yes,"
said Lyra, in the same condition.
"And so do I,"
she added stubbornly. Lyra learned nothing from that episode except that playing gobblers led to interesting places. She remembered her uncle's words in their last interview and began to explore underground, for what was above ground was only a small fraction of the whole. Like some enormous fungus whose root system extended over acres, Jordan, finding itself jostling for space above ground with St. Michael's College on one side, Gabriel College on the other, and the university library behind, had begun, sometime in the Middle Ages, to spread below the surface. Tunnels, shafts, vaults, cellars, staircases had so hollowed out the earth below Jordan and for several hundred yards around it that there was almost as much air below ground as above. Jordan College stood on a sort of froth of stone, and now that Lyra had the taste for exploring it, she abandoned her usual haunt, the irregular alps of the college roofs, and plunged with Roger into this netherworld. From playing at gobblers, she had turned to hunting them, for what could be more likely than that they were lurking out of sight below the ground? So one day she and Roger made their way into the crypt below the oratory. This was where generations of masters had been buried, each in his lead-lined oak coffin in niches along the stone walls. A stone tablet below each space gave their names. Simon Leclerc, Master 1765-1789, Sere Baton, Requiescant in Pace.
What's that mean?
The first part's his name, and the last bit's Roman. And there's the dates in the middle when he was master. And the other name must be his demon.
They moved along the silent vault, tracing the letters of more inscriptions. Francis Lyle, Master 1748-1765, Zohariel, Requiescant in Pace. Ignatius Cole, Master 1745-1748, Musca, Requiescant in Pace. On each coffin, Lyra was interested to see, a brass plaque bore a picture of a different being. this one a basilisk, this a serpent, this a monkey. She realized that they were images of the dead men's demons. As people became adult, their demons lost the power to change and assumed one shape, keeping it permanently.
These coffins have got skeletons in them.
Mouldering flesh and worms and maggots all twisting about in their eye sockets.
Must be ghosts down here,
said Roger, shivering pleasantly. Beyond the first crypt, they found a passage lined with stone shelves. Each shelf was partitioned off into square sections, and in each section rested a skull. Roger's demon, tail tucked firmly between her legs, shivered against him and gave a little quiet howl.
Hush,
he said. Lyra couldn't see Pantalaimon, but she knew his moth form was resting on her shoulder and probably shivering too. She reached up and lifted the nearest skull gently out of its resting place.
What are you doing? You ain't supposed to touch him.
She turned it over and over, taking no notice. Something suddenly fell out of the hole at the base of the skull, fell through her fingers and rang as it hit the floor, and she nearly dropped the skull in alarm.
It's a coin,
said Roger, feeling for it.
Might be treasure.
He held it up to the candle and they both gazed wide-eyed. It was not a coin, but a little disc of bronze with a crudely engraved inscription showing a cat.
It's like the ones on the coffins. It's his demon. Must be.
Better put it back,
said Roger uneasily, and Lyra upturned the skull and dropped the disc back into its immemorial resting place before returning the skull to the shelf. Each of the other skulls they found had its own demon coin, showing its owner's lifetime companion still close to him in death.
Who do you think these were when they were alive? Probably scholars, I reckon. Only the masters get coffins. There's probably been so many scholars all down the centuries that there wouldn't be room to bury the whole of them, so they just cut their heads off and keep them. That's the most important part of them anyway.
They found no gobblers, but the catacombs under the oratory kept Lyra and Roger busy for days. Once she tried to play a trick on some of the dead scholars by switching around the coins in their skulls so they were with the wrong demons. Pantalaimon became so agitated at this that he changed into a bat and flew up and down uttering shrill cries and flapping his wings in her face, but she took no notice. It was too good a joke to waste. She paid for it later, though. In bed in her narrow room at the top of Staircase 12, she was visited by a night ghast and woke up screaming at the three robed figures who stood at the bedside pointing their bony fingers before throwing back their cowls to show bleeding stumps where their heads should have been. Only when Pantalaimon became a lion and roared at them did they retreat, backing away into the substance of the wall until all that was visible was their arms, then their horny yellow-grey hands, then their twitching fingers, then nothing. First thing in the morning she hastened down to the catacombs and restored the demon coins to their rightful places and whispered,
"Sorry, sorry,"
to the skulls. The catacombs were much larger than the wine cellars, but they too had a limit. When Lyra and Roger had explored every corner of them and were sure there were no gobblers to be found there, they turned their attention elsewhere, but not before they were spotted leaving the crypt by the intercessor, who called them back into the oratory. The intercessor was a plump, elderly man known as Father Heist. It was his job to lead all the college services, to preach and pray and hear confessions. When Lyra was younger, he had taken an interest in her spiritual welfare, only to be confounded by her sly indifference and insincere repentances. She was not spiritually promising, he had decided. When they heard him call, Lyra and Roger turned reluctantly and walked, dragging their feet, into the great musty-smelling dimness of the oratory. Candles flickered here and there in front of images of the saints. A faint and distant clatter came from the organ loft where some repairs were going on. A servant was polishing the brass lectern. Father Heist beckoned from the vestry door.
Where have you been? I've seen you come in here two or three times now. What are you up to?
His tone was not accusatory. He sounded as if he were genuinely interested. His demon flicked a lizard tongue at them from her perch on his shoulder.
We wanted to look down in the crypt.
Whatever for?
The coffins. We wanted to see all the coffins.
But why?
She shrugged. It was her constant response when she was pressed.
And you?
He went on, turning to Roger. Roger's demon anxiously wagged her terrier tail to propitiate him.
What's your name?
Roger, Father.
If you're a servant, where do you work?
In the kitchen, Father.
Should you be there now?
Yes, Father.
Then be off with you.
Roger turned and ran. Lyra dragged her foot from side to side on the floor.
As for you, Lyra, I'm pleased to see you taking an interest in what lies in the oratory. You're a lucky child to have all this history around you.
Hmm.
But I wonder about your choice of companions. Are you a lonely child?
No.
Do you miss the society of other children?
No.
I don't mean Roger, the kitchen boy. I mean children such as yourself, nobly born children. Would you like to have some companions of that sort?
No.
But other girls, perhaps?
No.
You see, none of us would want you to miss all the usual childhood pleasures and pastimes. I sometimes think it must be a lonely life for you here among a company of elderly scholars, Lyra. Do you feel that?
No.
He tapped his thumbs together over his interlaced fingers, unable to think of anything else to ask this stubborn child.
If there is anything troubling you, you know you can come and tell me about it. I hope you feel you can always do that.
Yes.
Do you say your prayers?
Yes.
Good girl. We'll run along.
With a barely concealed sigh of relief, she turned and left. Having failed to find gobblers below ground, Lyra took to the streets again. She was at home there. Then, almost when she'd lost interest in them, the gobblers appeared in Oxford. The first Lyra heard of it was when a young boy went missing from an Egyptian family she knew. It was about the time of the horse fair, and the canal basin was crowded with narrow boats and butty boats, with traders and travellers, and the wharves along the waterfront in Jericho were bright with gleaming harness and loud with the clop of hooves and the clamour of bargaining. Lyra always enjoyed the horse fair. As well as the chance of stealing a ride on a less than well-attended horse, there were endless opportunities for provoking warfare. And this year she had a grand plan. Inspired by the capture of the narrowboat the year before, she intended this time to make a proper voyage before being turned out. If she and her cronies from the college kitchens could get as far as Abingdon, they could play havoc with the weir. But this year there was to be no war. Something else happened. Lyra was sauntering along the edge of the Port Meadow boatyard in the morning sun, without Roger for once. He had been detailed to wash the buttery floor. But with Hugh Lovett and Simon Parslow, passing a stolen cigarette from one to another and blowing out the smoke ostentatiously, when she heard a cry in a voice she recognised.
Well, what have you done with him, you half-assed pillock?
It was a mighty voice, a woman's voice, but a woman with lungs of brass and leather. Lyra looked around for her at once because this was Ma Costa, who had clouted Lyra dizzy on two occasions but given her hot gingerbread on three, and whose family was noted for the grandeur and sumptuousness of their boat. They were princes among Egyptians, and Lyra admired Ma Costa greatly, but she intended to be wary of her for some time yet, for theirs was the boat she had hijacked. One of Lyra's brat companions picked up a stone automatically when he heard the commotion, but Lyra said,
"Put it down! She's in a temper! She could snap your backbone like a twig!"
In fact, Ma Costa looked more anxious than angry. The man she was addressing, a horse trader, was shrugging and spreading his hands.
"Well, I dunno. He was here one minute and gone the next. I never saw where he went."
"He was helping you! He was holding your bloody horses for you!"
"Well, he should have stayed there, shouldn't he? Runs off in the middle of a job."
He got no further because Ma Costa suddenly dealt him a mighty blow on the side of the head and followed it up with such a volley of curses and slaps that he yelled and turned to flee. The other horse traders nearby jeered, and a flighty colt reared up in alarm.
"What's going on?"
said Lyra to an Egyptian child who'd been watching open-mouthed.
"What's she angry about?"
"It's her kid. It's Billy. She probably reckons the gobblers got him. They might have done too. I ain't seen him myself since..."
"The gobblers? Has they come to Oxford then?"
The Egyptian boy turned away to call to his friends, who were all watching Ma Costa.
"She don't know what's going on! She don't know the gobblers is here!"
Half a dozen brats turned with expressions of derision, and Lyra threw her cigarette down, recognising the cue for a fight. Everyone's demon instantly became warlike. Each child was accompanied by fangs or claws or bristling fur, and Pantalaimon, contemptuous of the limited imaginations of these Egyptian demons, became a dragon the size of a deerhound. But before they could all join battle, Ma Costa herself waded in, smacking two of the Egyptians aside and confronting Lyra like a prize fighter.
"You seen him? You seen Billy?"
"No, we just got here. I ain't seen Billy for months."
Ma Costa's demon was wheeling in the bright air above her head, a hawk, fierce yellow eyes snapping this way and that, unblinking. Lyra was frightened. No one worried about a child gone missing for a few hours, certainly not Egyptian. In the tight-knit Egyptian boat world, all children were precious and extravagantly loved, and a mother knew that if a child was out of sight, it wouldn't be far from someone else's who would protect it instinctively. But here was Ma Costa, a queen among the Egyptians, in a terror for a missing child. What was going on? Ma Costa looked half-blindly over the little group of children and turned away to stumble through the crowd on the wharf, bellowing for her child. At once the children turned back to one another, their feud abandoned in the face of her grief.
"What is them gobblers?"
said Simon Parslow, one of Lyra's companions. The first Egyptian boy said,
"You know, they've been stealing kids all over the country. They're pirates."
"They ain't pirates,"
corrected another Egyptian.
"They're cannibals. That's why they call them gobblers."
"They eat kids,"
said Lyra's other crony, Hugh Lovett, a kitchen boy from St. Michael's.
"No one knows. They take them away and they ain't never seen again."
"We all know that. We've been playing kids and gobblers for months, before you were, I bet. But I bet no one's seen them."
"They have,"
said one boy.
"Who then? Have you seen them? How do you know it ain't just one person?"
"Charlie seen them in Banbury,"
said Egyptian girl.
"They come and talk to this lady while another man took her little boy out the garden."
"Yeah,"
piped up Charlie, Egyptian boy.
"I seen them do it."
"What did they look like?"
"Well, I never properly saw them. I saw their truck, though. They come in a white truck. They put their little boy in the truck and drove off quick."
"But why do they call them gobblers?"
"'Cause they eat them. Someone told us in Northampton. They've been up there and all. This girl in Northampton, her brother was took. She said the men as took him told her they were going to eat him. Everyone knows that. They gobble him up."
Egyptian girl standing nearby began to cry loudly.
"That's Billy's cousin,"
said Charlie.
"Who saw Billy last?"
"Me!
I seen him holding Johnny Farrelly's old horse.
I seen him by the toppy apple
store. I seen him swinging on the crane."
When Lyra had sorted it out, she gathered that Billy had been seen for certain not less than 2 hours previously.
"So, sometime in the last 2 hours, there must have been gobblers here."
They all looked around, shivering in spite of the warm sun, the crowded wharf, the familiar smells of tar and horses and smoke leaf. The trouble was that because no one knew what these gobblers looked like, anyone might be a gobbler, as Lyra pointed out to the appalled gang, who were now all under her sway, colleges and Egyptians alike.
"They're bound to look like ordinary people, else they'd be seen at once. If they only came at night, they could look like anything. But if they come in the daylight, they've got to look ordinary. So any of these people might be gobblers."
"They ain't,"
said Egyptian uncertainly.
"I know them all."
"All right, not these, but anyone else. Let's go and look for them, and their white truck."
And that precipitated a swarm. Other searchers soon joined the first ones, and before long, 30 or more Egyptian children were racing from end to end of the wharves, running in and out of stables, scrambling over the cranes and derricks in the boatyard, leaping over the fence into the wide meadow, swinging 15 at a time on the old swing bridge over the green water, and running full pelt through the narrow streets of Jericho, between the little brick terraced houses and into the great square-towered oratory of St. Barnabas the chemist. Half of them didn't know what they were looking for and thought it was just a lark, but those closest to Lyra felt a real fear and apprehension every time they glimpsed a solitary figure down an alley or in the dimness of the oratory. Was it a gobbler? But of course it wasn't. Eventually, with no success and with the shadow of Billy's real disappearance hanging over them all, the fun faded away. As Lyra and the two college boys left Jericho when supper time neared, they saw the Egyptians gathering on the wharf next to where the Costa's boat was moored. Some of the women were crying loudly, and the men were standing in angry groups, with all their demons agitated and rising in nervous flight or snarling at shadows.
"I bet them gobblers wouldn't dare come in here,"
said Lyra to Simon Parslow as the two of them stepped over the threshold into the Great Lodge of Jordan.
"No, but I know there's a kid missing from the market."
"Who?"
She knew most of the market children, but she hadn't heard of this.
"Jessie Reynolds, out the Saddler's. She weren't there at shutting up time yesterday, and she'd only gone for a bit of fish for her dad's tea. She never come back, and no one had seen her. They searched all through the market and everywhere."
"I never heard about that,"
said Lyra, indignant. She considered it a deplorable lapse on the part of her subjects not to tell her everything and at once.
"Well, it was only yesterday. She might have turned up now."
"I'm going to ask,"
said Lyra, and turned to leave the lodge. But she hadn't got out of the gate before the porter called her.
"Here, Lyra! You're not to go out again this evening. Master's orders."
"Why not?"
"I told you, master's orders. He says if you come in, you stay in."
"You catch me,"
she said, and darted out before the old man could leave his doorway. She ran across the narrow street and down into the alley where the vans unloaded goods for the covered market. This being shutting up time, there were few vans there now, but a knot of youths stood smoking and talking by the central gate opposite the high stone wall of St. Michael's College. Lyra knew one of them, a 16-year-old she admired because he could spit further than anyone she'd ever heard of, and she went and waited humbly for him to notice her.
"Yeah? What you want?"
he said finally.
"Is Jesse Reynolds disappeared?"
"Yeah? Why?"
"'Cause Egyptian kid disappeared today and all."
"They're always disappearing, Egyptians. After every horse fair, they disappear."
"So do horses,"
said one of his friends.
"This is different. This is a kid. We was looking for him all afternoon, and the other kid said the gobblers got him."
"The what?"
"The gobblers. Ain't you heard of the gobblers?"
It was news to the other boys as well, and apart from a few coarse comments, they listened closely to what she told them.
"Gobblers,"
said Lyra's acquaintance, whose name was Dick.
"It's stupid. These Egyptians, they pick up all kinds of stupid ideas."
"They said there was gobblers in Banbury a couple of weeks ago, and there was 5 kids taken. They probably come to Oxford now to get kids from us. It must have been them what got Jesse."
"There was a kid lost over Cowley way,"
said one of the other boys.
"I remember now. My auntie, she was there yesterday because she sells fish and chips out of a van, and she heard about it. Some little boy, that's it. I don't know about the gobblers, though. They ain't real gobblers, just a story."
"They are. The Egyptians seen them. They reckon they eat the kids they catch and..."
She stopped in mid-sentence because something had suddenly come into her mind. During that strange evening she'd spent hidden in the retiring room, Lord Asriel had shown a lantern slide of a man with streams of light pouring from his hand, and there'd been a small figure beside him with less light around it, and he'd said it was a child, and someone had asked if it was a severed child, and her uncle had said no, that was the point. Lyra remembered that severed meant cut. And then something else hit Lyra's heart. Where was Roger? She hadn't seen him since the morning. Suddenly she felt afraid. Pantalaimon, as a miniature lion, sprang into her arms and growled. She said goodbye to the youths by the gate and walked quietly back into Turl Street, and then ran full pelt for Jordan Lodge, tumbling in through the door a second before the now cheetah-shaped demon. The porter was sanctimonious.
"I had to ring the master and tell him. He ain't pleased at all. I wouldn't be in your shoes, not for money, I wouldn't."
"Where's Roger?"
"I ain't seen him. You'll be for it too. Ooh, when Mr. Corson catches him."
Lyra ran to the kitchen and thrust her way into the hot, clangorous, steaming bustle.
"Where's Roger?"
"Clear off, Lyra. We're busy here."
"But where is he? Has he turned up or not?"
No one seemed interested.
"But where is he? You must have heard."
Lyra shouted at the chef, who boxed her ears and sent her storming away. Bernie, the pastry cook, tried to calm her down, but she wouldn't be consoled.
"They got him! Them bloody gobblers! They all catch him and bloody kill him! I hate him! You don't care about Roger!"
"Lyra, we all care about Roger!"
"You don't! Else you'd all stop work and go and look for him right now! I hate you!"
"There could be a dozen reasons why Roger ain't turned up. Listen to sense. We got dinner to prepare and serve in less than an hour. The master's got guests in the lodging, and he'll be eating over there, and that means Chef will have to attend to getting the food there quick so it don't go cold. And what with one thing and another, Lyra, life's got to go on. I'm sure Roger will turn up."
Lyra turned and ran out of the kitchen, knocking over a stack of silver dish covers and ignoring the roar of anger that arose. She sped down the steps and across the quadrangle, between the chapel and Palmer's Tower, and into the Yaxley Quad, where the oldest buildings of the college stood. Pantalaimon scampered before her, flowing up the stairs to the very top where Lyra's bedroom was. Lyra barged open the door, dragged her rickety chair to the window, flung wide the casement, and scrambled out. There was a lead-lined stone gutter a foot wide just below the window, and once she was standing in that, she turned and clambered up over the rough tiles until she stood on the topmost ridge of the roof. There she opened her mouth and screamed. Pantalaimon, who always became a bird once on the roof, flew round and round, shrieking rook shrieks with her. The evening sky was awash with peach, apricot, cream, tender little ice cream clouds in a wide orange sky. The spires and towers of Oxford stood around them, level but no higher. The green woods of Chateau Vert and White Ham rose on either side to the east and the west. Rooks were cawing somewhere, and bells were ringing, and from the oxpens the steady beat of a gas engine announced the ascent of the evening Royal Mail Zeppelin for London. Lyra watched it climb away beyond the spire of St. Michael's Chapel, as big at first as the tip of her little finger when she held it at arm's length, and then steadily smaller until it was a dot in the pearly sky. She turned and looked down into the shadowed quadrangle, where the black-gowned figures of the scholars were already beginning to drift in ones and twos towards the buttery, their demons strutting or fluttering alongside or perching calmly on their shoulders. The lights were going on in the hall. She could see the stained-glass windows gradually beginning to glow as a servant moved up the tables, lighting the naphtha lamps. The steward's bell began to toll, announcing half an hour before dinner. This was her world. She wanted it to stay the same for ever and ever, but it was changing around her, for someone out there was stealing children. She sat on the roof ridge, chin in hands.
"We better rescue him, Pantalaimon,"
he answered in his rook voice from the chimney.
"It'll be dangerous."
"Of course I know that."
"Remember what they said in the retiring room?"
"What?"
"Something about a child up in the Arctic? The one that wasn't attracting the dust?"
"They said it was an entire child. What about it?"
"That might be what they're going to do to Roger and the Egyptians and the other kids."
"What?"
"Well, what does entire mean?"
"I don't know. They cut them in half, probably. I reckon they make slaves out of them. That'd be more use. They probably got mines up there.
Oh.
Uranium mines for atom craft. I bet that's what it is. And if they sent grown-ups down the mine, they'd be dead, so they use kids instead because they cost less. That's what they've done with him."
"I think that..."
But what Pantalaimon thought had to wait because someone began to shout from below.
"Lyra! Lyra! You come in this instant!"
There was a banging on the window frame. Lyra knew the voice and the impatience. It was Mrs. Lonsdale, the housekeeper. There was no hiding from her. Tight-faced, Lyra slid down the roof and into the gutter, and then climbed in through the window again. Mrs. Lonsdale was running some water into the little chipped basin, to the accompaniment of a great groaning and hammering from the pipes.
"The number of times you've been told about going out there! Look at you! Just look at your skirt, it's filthy! Take it off at once and wash yourself while I look for something decent that ain't torn. Why, you can't keep yourself clean and tidy."
Lyra was too sulky even to ask why she was having to wash and dress, and no grown-up ever gave reasons of their own accord. She dragged the dress over her head and dropped it on the narrow bed, and began to wash desultorily while Pantalaimon, a canary now, hopped closer and closer to Mrs. Lonsdale's demon, a stolid retriever, trying in vain to annoy him.
"Look at the state of this wardrobe. You ain't hung nothing up for weeks. Oh, look at the creases in this."
Look at this, look at that. Lyra didn't want to look. She shut her eyes as she rubbed at her face with the thin towel.
"You'll just have to wear it as it is. There ain't time to take an iron to it. God bless me, girl, your knees. Look at the state of them."
"Don't want to look at nothing."
Mrs. Lonsdale smacked her leg.
"Wash. You get all that dirt off."
"Why? I never wash my knees usually. No one's going to look at my knees. What have I got to do all this for? You don't care about Roger neither any more than Chef does. I'm the only one that... Ow!"
Another smack on the other leg.
"None of that nonsense. I'm a Parslow, same as Roger's father. He's my second cousin. I bet you didn't know that, because I bet you never asked, Miss Lyra. I bet it never occurred to you. Don't you chide me with not caring about the boy. God knows I even care about you, and you give me little enough reason and no thanks."
She seized the flannel and rubbed Lyra's knees so hard she left the skin bright pink and sore, but clean.
"The reason for this is you're going to have dinner with the master and his guests. Oh, I hope to God you behave. Speak when you're spoken to, be quiet and polite, smile nicely, and don't you ever say dunno when someone asks you a question."
She dragged the best dress onto Lyra's skinny frame, tugged it straight, fished a bit of red ribbon out of the tangle in a drawer, and brushed Lyra's hair with a coarse brush.
"If they'd let me know earlier, I could have given your hair a proper wash. Well, that's too bad. As long as they don't look too close. There, now, stand up straight. Where's those best patent leather shoes?"
5 minutes later, Lyra was knocking on the door of the master's lodging, the grand and slightly gloomy house that opened into the Yaxley quadrangle and backed onto the library garden. Pantalaimon, an ermine now for politeness, rubbed himself against her leg. The door was opened by the master's manservant Cousins, an old enemy of Lyra's, but both knew that this was a state of truce.
"Mrs. Lonsdale said I was to come."
"Yes,"
said Cousins, stepping aside.
"The master's in the drawing room."
He showed her into the large room that overlooked the library garden. The last of the sun shone into it, through the gap between the library and Palmer's Tower and lit up the heavy pictures and the glum silver the master collected. It also lit up the guests, and Lyra realized why they weren't going to dine in hall. Three of the guests were women.
"Ah, Lyra,"
said the master.
"I'm so glad you could come. Guzzens, could you find some sort of soft drink? Dame Hannah, I don't think you've met Lyra. Lord Azrael's niece, you know."
Dame Hannah Ralph was the head of one of the women's colleges, an elderly grey-haired lady whose demon was a marmoset. Lyra shook hands as politely as she could, and was then introduced to the other guests, who were, like Dame Hannah, scholars from other colleges and quite uninteresting. Then the master came to the final guest.
"Mrs. Coulter, this is our Lyra. Lyra, come and say hello to Mrs. Coulter."
"Hello, Lyra,"
said Mrs. Coulter. She was beautiful and young. Her sleek black hair framed her cheeks, and her demon was a golden monkey. Chapter 4. The Alethiometer.
"I hope you'll sit next to me at dinner,"
said Mrs. Coulter, making room for Lyra on the sofa.
"I'm not used to the grandeur of a master's lodging. You'll have to show me which knife and fork to use."
"Are you a female scholar?"
said Lyra. She regarded female scholars with a proper Jordan disdain. There were such people, but poor things, they could never be taken more seriously than animals dressed up and acting a play. Mrs. Coulter, on the other hand, was not like any female scholar Lyra had seen, and certainly not like the two serious elderly ladies who were the other female guests. Lyra had asked the question expecting the answer no, in fact, for Mrs. Coulter had such an air of glamour that Lyra was entranced. She could hardly take her eyes off her.
"Not really. I'm a member of Dame Hannah's college, but most of my work takes place outside Oxford. Tell me about yourself, Lyra. Have you always lived at Jordan College?"
Within 5 minutes, Lyra had told her everything about her half-wild life. Her favourite routes over the rooftops, the battle of the clay beds, the time she and Roger had caught and roasted a rook, her intention to capture a narrowboat from the Egyptians and sail it to Abingdon, and so on. She even, looking around and lowering her voice, told her about the trick she and Roger had played on the skulls in the crypt.
"And these ghosts came, right? They came to my bedroom without their heads. They couldn't talk except for making sort of gurgling noises, but I knew what they wanted all right, so I went down next day and put their coins back. They'd probably have killed me else."
"You're not afraid of danger, then?"
said Mrs. Coulter admiringly. They were at dinner by this time, and, as Lyra had hoped, sitting next to each other. Lyra ignored completely the librarian on her other side and spent the whole meal talking to Mrs. Coulter. When the ladies withdrew for coffee, Dame Hannah said,
"Tell me, Lyra, are they going to send you to school?"
Lyra looked blank.
I don't know,
she said.
"Probably not,"
she added for safety.
"I wouldn't want to put them to any trouble,"
she went on piously.
"Or expense. It's probably better if I just go on living at Jordan and getting educated by the scholars here, when they've got a bit of spare time. Being as they're here already, they're probably free."
"And does your uncle, Lord Azrael, have any plans for you?"
said the other lady, who was a scholar at the other women's college.
"Yes, I expect so. Not school, though. He's going to take me to the north next time he goes."
"I remember him telling me."
Lyra blinked. The two female scholars sat up very slightly, though their demons, either well-behaved or torpid, did no more than flick their eyes at each other.
"I met him at the Royal Arctic Institute. As a matter of fact, it's partly because of that meeting that I'm here today."
"Are you an explorer too?"
"In a kind of way. I've been to the north several times. Last year I spent 3 months in Greenland making observations of the aurora."
That was it. Nothing and no one else existed now for Lyra. She gazed at Mrs. Coulter with awe and listened rapt and silent to her tales of igloo building, of seal hunting, of negotiating with the Lapland witches. The two female scholars had nothing so exciting to tell, and sat in silence until the men came in. Later, when the guests were preparing to leave, the master said,
"Stay behind, Lyra. I'd like to talk to you for a minute or two. Go to my study, child. Sit down there and wait for me."
Puzzled, tired, exhilarated, Lyra did as he told her. Cousins, the manservant, showed her in and pointedly left the door open so that he could see what she was up to from the hall, where he was helping people on with their coats. Lyra watched for Mrs. Coulter, but she didn't see her, and then the master came into the study and shut the door. He sat down heavily in the armchair by the fireplace. His demon flapped up to the chair back and sat by his head, her old hooded eyes on Lyra. The lamp hissed gently as the master said,
"So, Lyra, you've been talking to Mrs. Coulter. Did you enjoy hearing what she said?
Yes.
She is a remarkable lady.
She's wonderful. She's the most wonderful person I've ever met.
The master sighed. In his black suit and black tie, he looked as much like his demon as anyone could. And suddenly Lyra thought that one day, quite soon, he would be buried in the crypt under the oratory, and an artist would engrave a picture of his demon on the brass plate for his coffin, and her name would share the space with his.
I should have made time before now for a talk with you, Lyra,
he said after a few moments.
I was intending to do so in any case, but it seems that time is further on than I thought. You've been safe here in Jordan, my dear. I think you've been happy. You haven't found it easy to obey us, but we are very fond of you. And you've never been a bad child. There's a lot of goodness and sweetness in your nature, and a lot of determination. You're going to need all of that. Things are going on in the wide world I would have liked to protect you from. By keeping you here in Jordan, I mean. But that's no longer possible.
She merely stared. Were they going to send her away?
You knew that sometime you'd have to go to school. We've taught you some things here, but not well or systematically. Our knowledge is of a different kind. You need to know things that elderly men are not able to teach you, especially at the age you are now. You must have been aware of that. You're not a servant's child, either. We couldn't put you out to be fostered by a town family. They might have cared for you in some ways, but your needs are different. You see, what I'm saying to you, Lyra, is that the part of your life that belongs to Jordan College is coming to an end.
No. No, I don't want to leave Jordan. I like it here. I want to stay here forever.
When you're young, you do think that things last forever. Unfortunately, they don't. Lyra, it won't be long. A couple of years at most, before you will be a young woman. And not a child anymore. A young lady. And believe me, you'll find Jordan College a far from easy place to live in then.
But it's my home.
It has been your home, but now you need something else.
Not school. I'm not going to school.
You need female company, female guidance.
The word female only suggested female scholars to Lyra, and she involuntarily made a face. To be exiled from the grandeur of Jordan, the splendor and fame of its scholarship, to a dingy brick-built boarding house of a college at the northern end of Oxford, with dowdy female scholars who smelled of cabbage and mothballs like those two at dinner. The master saw her expression, and saw Pantalaimon's polecat eyes flash red.
But suppose it were Mrs. Coulter?
Instantly, Pantalaimon's fur changed from coarse brown to downy white. Lyra's eyes widened.
Really?
She is by way of being acquainted with Lord Asriel. Your uncle, of course, is very concerned with your welfare. And when Mrs. Coulter heard about you, she offered at once to help. There is no Mr. Coulter, by the way. She is a widow. Her husband died very sadly in an accident some years ago. So you might bear that in mind before you ask.
Lyra nodded eagerly and said,
And she's really going to look after me?
Would you like that?
Yes.
She could hardly sit still. The master smiled. He smiled so rarely that he was out of practice, and anyone watching, Lyra wasn't in a state to notice, would have said it was a grimace of sadness.
Well, we'd better ask her in to talk about it.
He left the room, and when he came back a minute later with Mrs. Coulter, Lyra was on her feet, too excited to sit. Mrs. Coulter smiled, and her demon bared his white teeth in a grin of imp-like pleasure. As she passed her on the way to the armchair, Mrs. Coulter touched Lyra's hair briefly, and Lyra felt a current of warmth flow into her, and blushed. When the master had poured some brandwine for her, Mrs. Coulter said,
So, Lyra, I'm to have an assistant, am I?
Yes,
said Lyra simply. She would have said yes to anything.
There's a lot of work I need help with.
I can work.
And we might have to travel.
I don't mind, I'd go anywhere.
But it might be dangerous. We might have to go to the north.
Soon?
Possibly. But you know you'll have to work very hard. You'll have to learn mathematics and navigation and celestial geography.
Will you teach me?
Yes.
And you'll have to help me by making notes and putting my papers in order and doing various pieces of basic calculation and so on. And because we'll be visiting some important people, we'll have to find you some pretty clothes. There's a lot to learn, Lyra.
I don't mind. I want to learn it all.
I'm sure you will. When you come back to Jordan College, you'll be a famous traveller. Now, we're going to leave very early in the morning by the Dawn Zeppelin, so you'd better run along and go straight to bed. I'll see you at breakfast. Good night.
Good night,
said Lyra, and, remembering the few manners she had, turned at the door and said,
Good night, Master.
Sleep well.
And thanks,
Lyra added to Mrs. Coulter. She did sleep, finally, though Pantalaimon wouldn't settle until she snapped at him when he became a hedgehog out of pique. It was still dark when someone shook her awake.
Lyra, shh, don't start. Wake up, child.
It was Mrs. Lonsdale. She was holding a candle and she bent over and spoke quietly, holding Lyra still with her free hand.
Listen, the master wants to see you before you join Mrs. Coulter for breakfast. Get up quickly and run across to the lodging now. Go into the garden and tap at the French window of the study. You understand?
Fully awake and on fire with puzzlement, Lyra nodded and slipped her bare feet into the shoes Mrs. Lonsdale put down for her.
Never mind washing, that'll do later. Go straight down and come straight back. I'll start your packing and have something for you to wear. Hurry now.
The dark quadrangle was still full of the chill night air. Overhead the last stars were still visible, but the light from the east was gradually soaking into the sky above the hall. Lyra ran into the library garden and stood for a moment in the immense hush, looking up at the stone pinnacles of the chapel, the pearl-green cupola of the Sheldon building, the white-painted lantern of the library. Now that she was going to leave these sights, she wondered how much she'd miss them. Something stirred in the study window, and a glow of light shone out for a moment. She remembered what she had to do and tapped on the glass door. It opened almost at once.
Good girl. Come in quickly. We haven't got long,
said the master, and drew the curtain back across the door as soon as she had entered. He was fully dressed in his usual black.
Aren't I going after all?
Yes, I can't prevent it,
said the master, and Lyra didn't notice at the time what an odd thing that was to say.
Lyra, I'm going to give you something, and you must promise to keep it private. Will you swear to that?
Yes.
He crossed to the desk and took from a drawer a small package wrapped in black velvet. When he unfolded the cloth, Lyra saw something like a large watch or a small clock, a thick disc of gold and crystal. It might have been a compass or something of the sort.
What is it?
It's an alethiometer. It's one of only six that were ever made. Lyra, I urge you again, keep it private. It would be better if Mrs. Coulter didn't know about it. Your uncle...
But what does it do?
It tells you the truth. As for how to read it, you'll have to learn by yourself. Now, go, it's getting lighter. Hurry back to your room before anyone sees you.
He folded the velvet over the instrument and thrust it into her hands. It was surprisingly heavy. Then he put his own hands on either side of her head and held her gently for a moment. She tried to look up at him and said,
What were you going to say about Uncle Asriel?
Your uncle presented it to Jordan College some years ago. He might...
Before he could finish, there came a soft, urgent knock on the door. She could feel his hands give an involuntary tremor.
Quick now, child. The powers of this world are very strong. Men and women are moved by tides much fiercer than you can imagine, and they sweep us all up into the current. Go well, Lyra. Bless you, child. Bless you. Keep your own counsel.
Thank you, Master.
Clutching the bundle to her breast, she left the study by the garden door, looking back briefly once to see the Master's demon watching her from the windowsill. The sky was lighter already. There was a faint, fresh stir in the air.
What's that you've got?
Said Mrs. Lonsdale, closing the battered little suitcase with a snap.
The master gave it me. Can't it go in a suitcase?
Too late. I'm not opening it now. It'll have to go in your coat pocket, whatever it is. Hurry on down to the buttery. Don't keep them waiting.
It was only after she'd said goodbye to the few servants who were up, and to Mrs. Lonsdale, that she remembered Roger. And then she felt guilty for not having thought of him once since meeting Mrs. Coulter. How quickly it had all happened. But no doubt Mrs. Coulter would help her look for him, and she was bound to have powerful friends who could get him back from wherever he disappeared to. He was bound to turn up eventually. And now she was on her way to London, sitting next to the window in a Zeppelin, no less, With Pantalaimon's sharp little ermine paws digging into her thigh while his front paws rested against the glass he gazed through. On Lyra's other side, Mrs. Coulter sat working through some papers, but she soon put them away and talked. Such brilliant talk. Lyra was intoxicated. Not about the North this time, but about London and the restaurants and ballrooms, the soirees at embassies or ministries, the intrigues between Whitehall and Westminster. Lyra was almost more fascinated by this than by the changing landscape below the airship. What Mrs. Coulter was saying seemed to be accompanied by a scent of grown-upness, something disturbing but enticing at the same time. It was the smell of glamour. The landing in Vauxhall Gardens, the boat ride across the wide brown river, the grand mansion block on the embankment where a stout commissionaire, a sort of porter with medals, saluted Mrs. Coulter and winked at Lyra, who sized him up expressionlessly. And then the flat. Lyra could only gasp. She had seen a great deal of beauty in her short life, but it was Jordan College beauty, Oxford beauty, grand and stony and masculine. In Jordan College, much was magnificent, but nothing was pretty. In Mrs. Coulter's flat, everything was pretty. It was full of light, for the wide windows faced south, and the walls were covered in a delicate gold and white striped wallpaper. Charming pictures in gilt frames, an antique looking-glass, fanciful sconces bearing ambaric lamps with frilled shades, and frills on the cushions too, and flowery valances over the curtain rail, and a soft green leaf-patterned carpet underfoot. And every surface was covered, it seemed to Lyra's innocent eye, with pretty little china boxes and shepherdesses and harlequins of porcelain. Mrs. Coulter smiled at her admiration.
Yes, Lyra, there's such a lot to show you. Take your coat off and I'll take you to the bathroom. You can have a wash and then we'll have some lunch and go shopping.
The bathroom was another wonder. Lyra was used to washing with hard yellow soap in a chipped basin, where the water that struggled out of the taps was warm at best and often flecked with rust. But here the water was hot, the soap rose pink and fragrant, the towels thick and cloud soft, and around the edge of the tinted mirror there were little pink lights, so that when Lyra looked into it she saw a softly illuminated figure quite unlike the Lyra she knew. Pantalaimon, who was imitating the form of Mrs. Coulter's demon, crouched on the edge of the basin making faces at her. She pushed him into the soapy water and suddenly remembered the alethiometer in her coat pocket. She'd left the coat on a chair in the other room. She'd promised the master to keep it secret from Mrs. Coulter. Oh, this was confusing. Mrs. Coulter was so kind and wise, whereas Lyra had actually seen the master trying to poison Uncle Azrael. Which of them did she owe most obedience to? She rubbed herself dry hastily and hurried back to the sitting room, where her coat still lay untouched, of course.
Ready? I thought we'd go to the Royal Arctic Institute for lunch. I'm one of the very few female members, so I might as well use the privileges I have.
20 minutes' walk took them to a grand stone-fronted building where they sat in a wide dining room with snowy cloths and bright silver on the tables, and ate calf's liver and bacon.
Calf's liver is all right,
Mrs. Coulter told her.
And so is seal liver. But if you're stuck for food in the Arctic, you mustn't eat bear liver. That's full of a poison that'll kill you in minutes.
As they ate, Mrs. Coulter pointed out some of the members at the other tables.
Do you see the elderly gentleman with the red tie? That's Colonel Carbourne. He made the first balloon flight over the North Pole. And the tall man by the window who's just got up is Dr. Broken Arrow.
Is he a Skraeling?
Yes. He was the man who mapped the ocean currents in the Great Northern Ocean.
Lyra looked at them all, these great men, with curiosity and awe. They were scholars, no doubt about that, but they were explorers too. Dr. Broken Arrow would know about bear livers. She doubted whether the librarian of Jordan College would. After lunch, Mrs. Coulter showed her some of the precious Arctic relics in the Institute Library. The harpoon with which the great whale Grimmsdor had been killed. The stone carved with an inscription in an unknown language which was found in the hand of the explorer Lord Rook, frozen to death in his lonely tent. A fire striker used by Captain Hudson on his famous voyage to Van Tieren's land. She told the story of each one, and Lyra felt her heart stir with admiration for these great, brave, distant heroes. And then they went shopping. Everything on this extraordinary day was a new experience for Lyra, but shopping was the most dizzying. To go into a vast building full of beautiful clothes, where people let you try them on, where you looked at yourself in mirrors, and the clothes were so pretty. Lyra's clothes had come to her through Mrs. Lonsdale, and a lot of them had been handed down and much mended. She had seldom had anything new, and when she had, it had been picked for wear and not for looks, and she had never chosen anything for herself. And now to find Mrs. Coulter suggesting this and praising that and...